You are obviously all gluttons for punishment, so. You're back. I'm here to deliver more. I love Henry IV, Part 2. It's not as well known as Part 1. It is not as accessible as Part 1. It could never be as popular as Part 1. Part 1 is a young man's play, filled with youthful energy, good spirits, bravery, battle scenes. I made the point when I started talking about these plays that each one was different and unique, even though they comprised a complete and total whole. And, yeah, I think some people need some air, so. If Richard II was a tragedy and Henry IV Part I a historical comedy containing the mini-tragedy of Hotspur, Henry IV Part II is an elegy. It's a farewell to a dying world. It is filled with old men who are leaving this earth. It is filled with times gone by, a way of life that is ending, a way of looking at the world that is ending. It is a play filled with corruption and disease, a world whose time is past and must be swept away. There is sorrow in the play. There is a heaviness in the play. Falstaff is still in the play, so we have good humor, but the humor is very different. Now, Shakespeare himself makes clear to his audience that something different is coming in this play. Because it begins with an induction or a little prologue, which he's done often enough in the past, but he's never done anything like this. This historical play begins with an allegorical character walking on stage and giving a speech. It simply reads, "Enter rumor, painted full of tongues," which means this allegorical character representing rumor walks on stage wearing a costume that has tongues painted all over it. This is very strange. See, nothing like it anywhere else in the history plays. It seems inappropriate here. So the audience is taken aback, and then rumor speaks. I'm going to give you the whole speech. It's necessary for understanding the play. Shakespeare is telling us what's coming. "Open your ears, for which of you will stop the vent of hearing when loud rumor speaks? I from the Orient to the drooping West, making the wind my post-horse, still unfold the axe commenced on this ball of earth. Upon my tongues continual slanders ride, the which in every language I pronounce, stuffing the ears of men with false reports. I speak of peace, while covert enmity under the smile of safety wounds the world. And who but rumor, who but only I, make fearful musters and prepare defense, whilst the big ear swollen with some other grief is thought with child by the stern tyrant war, and no such matter. Rumor is a pipe, blown by surmises, jealousies, conjectures, and of so easy and so plain a stop that the blunt monster with uncounted heads, the still discordant wavering multitude, can play upon it. But what need I thus my well-known body to anatomize among my hawk household? Why is rumor here? I run before King Harry's victory, who in a bloody field by Shrewsbury hath beaten down young Hotspur and his troops, quenching the flame of bold rebellion even with the rebel's blood. But what mean I to speak so true at first? My office is to know to noise abroad that Harry Monmouth fell under the wrath of noble Hotspur's sword, and that the king, before the Douglas rage, stooped his anointed head as low as death. This have I rumored through peasant towns, between the royal field of Shrewsbury and this worm-eaten hole of ragged stone, where Hotspur's father, old Northumberland, lies crafty sick." The posts come tiring on, and not a man of them brings other news than they have learned from me. From rumors, tongues they bring, smooth comforts false, worse than true wrong. It's a brilliant speech. What do we learn in it? One, old Northumberland was crafty sick. He betrayed his own son by pretending to be sick and not going to battle. And this is a play about old men betraying young men. And now young Hotspur is dead. There is an old order there that will be swept away. But the entire structure of this play is given to us in that speech. The entire structure of this play is about smooth comforts false. Expectations that characters in the play have that they are very certain of that are completely overturned. So it begins, Act 1, Scene 1, with old crafty sick Northumberland in his castle, wondering what's happened at the battle that he did not go to, and word comes to him, your son has triumphed, he killed Prince Hal, the king has fallen, the rebels have won, we're in control of England, a mighty victory. And by the end of the scene, other messengers show up with the truth. And that is the structure for the entire play. I'm going to go through major moments when that happens. Why did he structure the play this way? Well, for the simple reason that time is now moving forward. History is going forward. And if history teaches anything according to Shakespeare, it is whatever you expect to happen will not happen. Human beings may guess at what's going to occur, but many times not only are they wrong, but when they have expectations and make preparations for one end, time, history, God himself will deliver them somewhere else. We do not know the future, even though we pretend and hope to be able to have some sense of where things are going. Now, he will, to some degree, assuage that in the middle of the play a bit, but the events of the play make clear. The world of Henry IV, Part II, is a mistaken world, filled with false opinions, false hopes, and false dreams. And that world is about to go away, even as those who inhabit that world do not understand what has happened, their own role in it, or that it is inevitable, and what they are expecting is not what they are going to get. Now, we move on immediately. The second scene, one reason for this sequel, and one reason the sequel is written the way it is, Falstaff was an enormous popular success. Hugely popular character. Shakespeare brings him back. The audience demanded it. In fact, there is a legend, we don't know if it's true or not, I suspect it is, that Queen Elizabeth herself found Falstaff such a delightful character, she gave an order to Shakespeare to write a play in which Sir John and Falstaff falls in love. The Queen wanted to see Falstaff in love. And he wrote The Merry Wives of Windsor, which has a contemporary setting. Suddenly Falstaff is 200 years out of his time. Has lost some of his wit, becomes the butt of many jokes. Some think that he fooled the Queen by writing a different character and giving the same name. It's a very funny stage piece. It still works. But it has more prose in it than any other Shakespeare play, suggesting he wrote it very quickly, and perhaps at royal command. Point being, Falstaff was a very popular character. The audience wanted more of him. He dominates this play. He is in scene after scene after scene, but even here, he is not exactly the same. We first see him in triumph after the Battle of Shrewsbury. He is decked out. He supposedly killed Hotspur, even though Hal did it. He's taking the credit for it. Hal has given him a little page boy So now he's showing that he is indeed advancing in the ranks of the nobility and that he has a page boy walking with him. But as he points out, he thinks Hal did it just to make him look more foolish, because the page boy is a little tiny pipsqueak thing, and Falstaff is this enormous man, and between the two of them, everyone is laughing at what they're seeing there. But the first thing he does is he has, this is what the play is about. It's everywhere. Disease. Falstaff is worrying about his health. And he has sent a urine specimen to the doctor. And he has sent the page boy to find out, first line, Sirrah, you giant, what says the doctor to my water? And the page boy responds, he said, sir, the water itself was a good, healthy water. But for the party that owned it, he might have more diseases than he knew of. Urine is fine, but the man who gave the specimen could be very sick indeed. Falstaff says, men of all sorts take a pride to gird at me. The brain of this foolish compound clay man is not able to invent anything that attends to laughter more than I invent or is invented on me. I am not only witty in myself, but the cause that wit is in other men. He can be the butt of the jokes. He can make others come up with wit as well. And then he complains about Hal having put this. He says, this little boy walks before me. I walk like a sow that has overwhelmed all its litter but one. It's one little piglet walking ahead of me. It's funny stuff. However, interestingly enough, Hal does not show up with Falstaff until Act 2, Scene 4, One Little Meeting. Hal was, if you will, the sparring partner for Falstaff in part one. He's not now. The character that is there that Falstaff is constantly being witty with and sparring with is the Lord Chief Justice, old man who has served under King Henry IV, who in fact has imprisoned Prince Hal at one point because Hal struck him. And the Lord Chief Justice, following the law of the land, took the prince and put him in prison. So this is in the background. We learn about it. The sparring of wit is between old Jack Falstaff and the old Chief Justice, and this is not accidental. If the education of the prince, part one, was about courage on the battlefield, the education of the prince, part two, is about justice. The king rendering justice. Which also explains the overturning of expectations. If we go to the Greek definition of justice, the classic definition is rendering to each man what he has earned and deserves. That's justice. You get what you have earned or deserved, and that is just. But most of us, given our fallen human nature, expect or think we will get better than we deserve because we usually think better of ourselves than we actually are. So that when justice comes, we'll often complain that we didn't get what we deserved because we deserve better. It's for that reason, in Dante's Inferno, all the damned souls in hell are complaining constantly and blaming God for having put them there when they didn't deserve it. When what Dante makes clear throughout the Inferno is that God puts no one anywhere in hell, the individual souls, through freedom of the will, choose to be in hell. And by their choices, they're given what they have earned or deserve. God merely renders justice. Well, what's happening here, indeed, is justice is everywhere through the play. And what usually happens is that justice is harsh and not what the characters expected, because the characters have been expecting smooth comforts, which turn out to be false. There's some very delightful comedy between Falstaff and the Lord Chief Justice. I don't need to go through it. When you go back to the play, it's there, and you can get a clear sense of it. Falstaff is himself. He's very witty. He's very funny. But the Lord Chief Justice is warning him, and what we get, again, even in the comic plot, is an underlining of the main plot in that Mistress Quickly, the hostess at the inn where Falstaff drinks, has been promised marriage by this man and believed him. And she is now fed up because he's been promising to marry her for a long while, and he never seems to come through and fulfill the promise. So she is getting the local constabulary to go after him and do what he says he was going to do. It's another example of a smooth comfort false. She was going to be married to Sir John Falstaff, and it hasn't happened. Duh. But she doesn't understand it, and she wants justice. She wants to see fulfilled what he has promised her. Now, in the midst of all this, we have another rebellion beginning. Hotspur is dead, but Thomas Mowbray, you remember him, this is his son. He was exiled at the beginning of Richard II. His son has now come back, joined the rebels. Northumberland is still there, claiming he will support. This time he'll show up, he says. He will join them. The Archbishop of York has joined the rebels. We have another rebellion brewing that Henry IV has to deal with. So that throughout the beginning of the play, new rebellion, old men, and questions of justice. When we finally meet Prince Hal, and it's not until the second scene of the second act, he is not the character who triumphed at the end of Henry IV, Part 1. His very first line is to his friend Poins, "Before God, I am exceeding weary." And the prince himself has something of the heaviness of age and experience about him. He's tired of the life he has been living. "I tell thee, my heart bleeds inwardly that my father is so sick." Henry is dying. "And keeping such vile company as thou art," he says to his friend Poins, "hath in reason taken from me all ostentation of sorrow." My father's sick. I should feel sorrowful. I do, but no one will believe me. "What wouldst thou think of me if I should weep?" "I would think thee a most princely hypocrite." "It would be every man's thought. And thou art a blessed field. Thou art a blessed fellow to think as every man thinks. No one would believe my sorrow was sincere if I wept for my father. This is what it's come to." There is heaviness in him. There is weariness in him. And then a letter arrives from Falstaff. They haven't met. It's simply a letter. "Sir John Falstaff, knight to the son of the king nearest his father, Harry Prince of Wales, greeting. I will imitate the honorable Romans in brevity. I commend thee, and I leave thee. Be not too familiar with Poins, for he misuses thy favors so much that he swears thou art to marry his sister Nell. Repent at idle times as thou mayest, and so farewell. Thine by yea or no, which is as much to say as thou usest him. Jack Falstaff with my familiars, John with my brothers and sisters, and Sir John with all Europe." Prince turns to Poins and says, "Do you use me thus, Ned? Must I marry your sister?" "God send the wench no worse fortune. I never said so." And again a sense of betrayal, but it's obviously true. The prince marrying a commoner. They decide they'll go to the tavern and see Falstaff. We expect another big tavern scene. We're not going to get it. Before that happens, we get another betrayal, another expectation overturned. We're back with Lord Northumberland, the old man, crafty sick, who has said this time, "I will go fight with the rebels." He's preparing to go off, and Hotspur's widow, that we met in Part 1, Lady Percy, turns on him and says, "You betrayed your own son and left him to die on the battlefield, and now you will go fight with others? Oh, miracle of men, him did you leave, second to none, unseconded by you, to look upon the hideous god of war in disadvantage, to abide a field where nothing but the sound of Hotspur's name did seem defensible, so you left him. Never. Oh, never do his ghost the wrong to hold your honor more precise and nice with others than with him. Leave them, let them alone." And the old man says, "Yeah, that makes good sense." And betrays them a second time and runs off to Scotland. Smooth comforts false. This time Lord Northumberland will join us with his troops. And of course, word will come to them, he's gone again. We go to the tavern. Falstaff isn't drinking, he's whoring. It's not the same kind of comedy. Although Shakespeare keeps it light in some regards in that he gives the whore one of the best names in English literature. He calls her Doll Tearsheet. And she's so drunk she can't really get in much mischief. And poor mistress quickly is trying to sober up. But it's not wildly funny. And in fact, at one point when she's sitting on Falstaff's lap, if he has one, she tries to give him a little advice and says simply, "Thou whoresome little tidy Bartholomew boar pig, when wilt thou leave fighting of days and foining of nights, and begin to patch up thine old body for heaven?" "Peace, good doll. Do not speak like a death's head. Do not bid me remember mine end." Death and diseases everywhere hovering over the play. A new character comes in, who'll become important in Henry V, Pistol, who just shouts and rants and carries on. He shouts mangled phrases from popular other plays of the day and waves his sword and causes commotion. It's riotous stage action. It's not terribly funny. They shove him downstairs. The prince and Poins come in. They're looking at Falstaff with Doll Tearsheet. A wonderful line comes out, a classic. Look at the old man and the old woman of the night. And say, "Is it not strange that desire should so many years outlive performance?" It's a riotous, very funny line. But nothing happens in terms of a comic scene between the prince and Falstaff. Word comes there's another rebellion brewing, and the prince goes off to join his father. It's time to fight again. And his father is ill and needs him more than ever. "By heaven's points, I feel me much to blame, so idly to profane the precious time, when tempest of commotion, like the south born with black vapor, doth begin to melt and drop upon our bare unarmed hands. Give me my sword and cloak. Falstaff, good night." It's the last time we see them together until the last scene of the play. Falstaff, now comes in the sweetest morsel of the night, and we must hence and leave it unpicked. And he goes off to war again. They're all going off to war. We see Henry IV for the first time. Not till Act 3 of this play that begins his name. He's old. He's sick. He's troubled. He's dying. We see him in soliloquy, and what we get is the complaint. He cannot sleep. Now, one of the sad facts of growing older is you don't sleep as well. That's just a fact of nature. But if you're a king with burdens continuing to weigh on you, you even sleep less well. And when you've got the guilt of murder on your head, and you may stand it before the judgment seat of God any day, you're probably not going to sleep at all. "How many thousand of my poorest subjects are at this hour asleep? Oh, sleep. Oh, gentle sleep, nature's soft nurse. How have I frighted thee, that thou no more wilt weigh my eyelids down and steep my senses in forgetfulness? Why rather, sleep, liest thou in smoky cribs, upon uneasy pallets stretching thee and hushed with buzzing nightflies to thy slumber, than in the perfumed chambers of the great, under the canopies of costly state, and lulled with sound of sweetest melody?" The poorest of the poor can sleep, and sleep well. We just have flies buzzing around them. Here in the perfumed chambers of state, with soft music playing, the king cannot sleep. It's a great salute. It's a troubled soul. It's age, it's death, it's guilt permeating the play. "Canst thou, O partial sleep..." I'm skipping the long metaphor of the sea boy up in the top of the mast in the storm, swaying back and forth and sound asleep, not troubled at all. "Canst thou, O partial sleep, give thy repose to the wet sea sun in an hour so rude, and in the calmest and most stillest night, with all appliances and means to boot, deny it to a king? Then happy low lie down, uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. Famous, famous lines. But again, in a situation, the man is in torment. The man is in torment and gives voice to it. Warwick comes in, one of his advisors. And Henry complains that one cannot see what's coming when one is young. O God, that one might read the book of fate and see the revolution of the times, make mountains level, and the continent weary of solid firmness melt itself into the sea. And other times to see the beachy girdle of the ocean too wide for nature's hips, how chances, mocks, and changes fill the cup of alteration with diverse liquors. We don't know what's coming. It's just change, transformation, constantly. Oh, if this were seen, the happiest youth, viewing his progress through what perils past, what crosses to ensue, would shut the book and sit him down and die. Disillusioned age. If any young person could see what life was going to hand him, he wouldn't go through it. He couldn't go through it. The problem, as Henry states it, you don't know what's coming other than changes. You're not going to get other than what you bargained for. And the whole thing is unfair. It's a vision from Shakespeare of history. It is unpredictable. We cannot control it. We don't know what's coming next. Smooth comforts false that can leave a man unhappy and bitter. But Warwick responds, there is a history in all men's lives, figuring the nature of the times deceased, the which observed, a man may prophesy with the near aim of the main chance of things as yet not come to life, who in their seeds and weak beginnings lie in treasury. We study history. We may not know exactly, but there are patterns. And you can learn those patterns. And you can make reasoned guesses as to what's to come and not be that surprised by it. Never perfect, never exact. It's the closest Shakespeare comes in any of his history plays to defending the notion of studying history. One can learn from it. One finds the patterns. But one can never pretend that the pattern will be exactly the same, or we will know exactly what's coming. We go off into the countryside. Falstaff is going to war. He's to recruit soldiers again. He's playing his old game. He's just getting the lowest of the low, and even if they will pay him off, he'll let them go home and not go into battle. But interestingly, where he goes, he's in Warwickshire. He's visiting his old friend from school days named Justice Shallow, whose cousin Justice Silence is visiting him at that time. And the old men sit around and talk about the old days, as old men do. They also talk about the coming of death. Justice Shallow. Jesu, Jesu, the mad days that I have spent, and to see how many of my old acquaintance are dead, we shall all follow, cousin. Certain 'tis certain, very sure, very sure. Death, as the psalmist says, is certain to all. All shall die. Have a good yoke of bullocks at Stamford Fair. What are they getting for cows? Talking of death and the next thing, what are cows selling for right now? By my troth, I was not there. Death is certain. Is old Double of your town living yet? Dead, sir. Jesu, Jesu, dead. He drew a good bow and dead. He shot a fine shot. John o' Gaunt loved him well and betted much money on his head. Dead. How a score of yous now? I just back and forth. Falstaff shows up and the old men sit around. After Falstaff has gone through the troops, Moldy, Shadow, Wart, Feeble, and Bullcalf. I mean, again, this is the king's army going into battle. Shallow asks him, they're reminiscing, the young days, their young days. Ah, 'twas a merry night, and is Jane Knight work alive? She lives, Master Shallow. She never could away with me. Oh, never, never. She would always say she could not abide Master Shallow. By the mass, I could anger her to the heart. She was then a bona roba. Doth she hold her own well? Old. Old, Master Shallow. Nay, she must be old. She cannot choose but be old. Certain, she's old. And had Robin Nightwork by old Nightwork before I came to Clemens Inn. That's 55 years ago. Ah, Cousin Silence, that thou hadst seen that that this night and I have seen. Ha, Sir John, said I well? We have heard the chimes at midnight, Master Shallow. Ah, it's touching stuff. It's silly. It's foolish. It's a world going away. The title of the Wells film, of course, comes from that. We have heard the chimes at midnight, Master Shallow. That we have. That we have. That we have. In faith, Sir John, we have. It's funny, it's heartbreaking, it's entirely different. It's a different kind of comedy. Off we go to war. Now, if the audience is expecting a big battle scene, smooth expectations false. We don't get it. There's no big battle scene in this play. Prince John is leading the king's army. The Archbishop of York, Thomas Mowbray, Hastings leading the other army. They meet in the Forest of Galtry. This is historically accurate. Before it goes to battle, the rebels send their objections to Prince John through Westmoreland. Westmoreland comes back and says, come talk, the prince is going to allow them. He will give in to your grievances. They come, there's a meeting between the two sides. Prince John of Lancaster says to the rebels, I like them all and do allow them well, and swear here by the honor of my blood, my father's purposes have been mistook. And some about him have too lavishly wrested his meaning and authority. My lord, these griefs shall be with speed redressed. Upon my soul, they shall. If this may please you, discharge your powers under their several counties as we will ours. And here between the armies, let's drink together, friendly and embrace, that all their eyes may bear these tokens home of our restored love and amity. There's going to be no war. We bring out the drinks. We raise our glasses. And Prince John says, well, now dismiss your army. The armies are all dismissed. And of course, you know what happens next. My Lord Hastings, I do arrest thee, traitor of high treason. And you, Lord Archbishop, and you, Lord Mowbray, of capital treason, I attach you both. Is this proceeding just? And honorable? Justice again. Is your assembly so? Your rebels against the king, is that just and honorable? The Archbishop to Prince John, will you thus break faith? By the way, this is what happened. This is historically accurate. Prince John, I pawn thee none. I promise you redress of these same grievances wherever you did complain, which by mine honor I will perform with the most Christian care. But for you, rebels, look to taste the dew meet for rebellion in such acts as yours. Well, you'll get what you want, but I'm putting you to death. And they were all killed. Smooth comforts false. The coming of justice that was unexpected. We see Falstaff on the battlefield, although he doesn't have to fight, but he has a little interchange with Prince John, whom he doesn't like. And then in one of the greatest speeches Shakespeare ever penned, he explains why he can't stand Prince John, but loves Prince Hal. I was lucky enough years ago to play Falstaff in both parts of Henry IV. The wonderful costumer from Baltimore, professional costumer, made me, as if it was necessary, but he did it anyway, a fat suit. It was put on in pieces. The fat It was all one suit, but it melded together. The fat came down to my wrists and my ankles, and I had an 80-inch waist, which is larger than what I naturally carry. It was the feeling was wonderful trying to walk in this thing. And then for the battle scenes, he girded me in chainmail, enough chainmail to encompass a normal army. So that when I walked out in the battle, it was tremendous. It was great. Now, this is the most difficult speech I ever had to do in my entire career on stage. This is a killer. I'm going to do it because I haven't done it in ages, and I love it. And I love it. Two reasons. One, it's one of Falstaff's great moments. It's one of Shakespeare's great speeches. And it's in praise of the drinking of alcohol. Within limitations, always, of course. The prince. Fare you well, Falstaff. I, in my condition, shall speak better of you than you deserve. I would you had the wit. 'Twere better than your dukedom. Good faith, this same young sober-blooded boy doth not love me, nor a man cannot make him laugh. But that's no marvel. He drinks no wine. There's never none of these demure boys come to any proof, for thin drink doth so overcool their blood, and making many fish meals, that they fall into a kind of male green sickness. And then, when they marry, they get wenches. They are generally fools and cowards, which some of us should be too, but for inflammation. A good sheriff's sack hath a twofold operation in it. It ascends me into the brain, dries me there all the foolish and dull and cruddy vapors which environ it, makes it apprehensive, quick, forgetive, full of nimble, fiery, and delectable shapes, which, delivered o'er the voice, the tongue, which is the birth, becomes excellent wit. The second property of your excellent sherris is the warming of the blood, which before, cold and settled, left the liver white and pale, which is the badge of pusillanimity and cowardice. But the sherris warms it and makes it coarse from the inwards to the parts extreme. It illumineth the face, which as a beacon gives warning to all the rest of this little kingdom man to arm. And then the vital commoners and inland petty spirits muster me all to their captain. The heart, who great and puffed up with his retinue, doth any deed of courage, and this valor comes of sherris, so that skill in the weapon is nothing without sack, for that sets it a work, and learning a mere hoard of gold kept by a devil, till sack commences it and sets it in act and use. Hereof comes it that Prince Harry is valiant, for the cold blood he did naturally inherit of his father, he hath, like lean, sterile, and bare land, manured, husbanded, and tilled, with excellent endeavor of drinking good and good store of fertile sherris, that he has become very hot and valiant. If I had 1,000 sons, the first humane principle I would teach them should be to forswear thin potations, and to addict themselves to sack. It's magnificent. My favorite compliment I ever got. We were in the final dress rehearsal for part two. There was a Navy commander who asked if he could bring his 5 children to the dress rehearsal. He said, I'm sure they'd behave in a performance, but I just feel safer bringing the dress rehearsal the night before. We said, fine, they can sit up in the balcony, no problem. He came in the next morning, said they're walking home, and his little 5-year-old daughter said to him, Daddy. He said, yes. She said, that fat man. He said, courage comes from beer. I thought a 5-year-old got it. Made it. Now, the overturned expectations continue. King Henry is dying and convinced that Hal has just wandered off again. But the final confrontation between father and son, the deathbed scene, stunning poetry. High drama. Hal returns. His father is collapsed. They put him in the bed. The crown is by his side. The young prince goes in, and thinks his father has died. And as a result, picks up the crown, having, it's a magnificent speech, I won't go through it, that he gives to the crown, puts it on his own head and leaves the room. His father wakes up. Who took the crown? He's then told, well, we left the prince with you. Calls in rage for his son to come, who says ashamedly as he hands the crown back to his father, I never thought to hear you speak again. Thy wish was, father, Harry, to that thought. I stay too long by thee. I weary thee. A father saying to his son, you wish me dead. Horrified. What, canst thou now forbear me half an hour? Then get thee gone and dig my grave yourself, and bid the merry bells ring to thine ear that thou art crowned, not that I am dead. Let all the tears that should bedew my hearse be drops of balm to sanctify thy head. Only compound me with forgotten dust. Give that which gave thee life unto the worms. Pluck down my officers. Break my decrees. For now a time has come to mock at form. He's talking like Richard. At this moment of death, he's using images from Richard. He's becoming poetic. We would say self-dramatizing. Is it fair? I don't know. He is at the point of death. He is in despair at what he sees happening to his kingdom. To the English court assemble now from every region apes of idleness. Now, neighbor confines, purge you of your scum. Have you a ruffian that will swear, drink, dance, revel the night, rob, murder, and commit the oldest sins, the newest kind of ways? Be happy. He will trouble you no more. England shall double his treble guilt. England shall give him officer, honor, might. For the fifth Harry from curbed license plucks the muzzle of restraint, and the wild dog shall flush his tooth on every innocent. Oh, my poor kingdom, sick with civil blows, when that my care could not withhold thy riots, what wilt thou do when riot is thy care? Oh, thou wilt be a wilderness again, peopled with wolves, thy old inhabitants. Harry makes his response. It's direct, it's honest, it's heartfelt, and his father believes it. There is a reconciliation between father and son at the moment of death. What's very interesting, though, is that the last thing on the old king's mind again is how he got the crown. We are at, again, it's a moment of judgment. He knows it. He's haunted by it. God knows, my son, by what bypaths and indirect crooked ways I met this crown. And I myself know well how troublesome it sat upon my head. To thee it shall descend with better quiet, better opinion, better confirmation. For all the soil of the achievement goes with me into the earth. And then he gives very practical information, the most frightening of which is this, saying, look, it's going to be easier for you, but it won't be easy. You've got to make my old enemies your friends. You've got to pull England back together. There's a way to do it. Be at thy course to busy, giddy minds with foreign quarrels. If you have internal domestic unrest, then the best thing to do is start a war someplace else. This piece of political advice continues to this day. Come up with your own examples. And as the economy continues to crumble, watch what the world leaders do. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Busy, giddy minds with foreign quarrels, that action henceforth out may waste the memory of the former days. More would I, but my lungs are so wasted that strength of speech is utterly denied me. How I came by the crown, O God, forgive, and grant it may with thee in true peace live. My gracious liege, you won it, wore it, kept it, gave it me. Then plain and right must my possession be, which I with more than with a common pain against all the world will rightfully maintain. Henry is carried off to die, ironically, in the Jerusalem chamber. Someone prophesied when he was young he would die in Jerusalem. He thought he'd go on a crusade and die in the Holy Land. No. He's dying in a little room called the Jerusalem chamber. Another expectation overturned. Now, what's very interesting. In Act 5, we get expectations overturned, but for the first time in the play in a positive direction. Henry IV is dead, Henry V is about to be crowned, and the Lord Chief Justice is sweating blood. He's the one who arrested the prince and had him thrown in prison. And he expects to get it in the neck now that the prince is king. And there is a magnificent scene where the about-to-be-crowned new king confronts the Lord Chief Justice and says to him, "You did this to me, didn't you?" And the Lord Chief Justice gives his excuse. "It was the law of the land. I swore an oath to your father to uphold the law. I didn't care if you were the prince of the realm. The law applies to everyone. I did what I must do." And then expects to get it. And Henry V says, "You are right, Justice, and you weigh this well. Therefore still bear the balance and the sword, and I do wish your honors may increase, till you do live to see a son of mine offend you and obey you as I did." Remember, I went to prison. "So shall I live to speak my father's words. Happy am I that have a man so bold that dares do justice on my proper son." And an expectation was overturned for the good. And indeed, Henry says, "You will be like a father to me now. I've lost my father. You will be my father. Advise me. You're an old man. You have wisdom. Advise me." It's a touching scene, but it also means we see what's coming because there's another old father that has to be removed from the scene. Falstaff is still with Justice Shallow. The war never takes place. So they're celebrating and doing what old men do when they get together and reminisce about old times. They're knocking them back, and they're all pretty well tooted. When in comes Pistol, who's arrived from London, who's speaking his usual gibberish, half-remembered lines of stage poetry and half-nonsense, and Falstaff begins to understand what he's saying and says, "What? Is the old king dead?" And Pistol says, "As nail in door." There's where it comes from, by the way. Dead as a doornail. That's the sort. Everything comes from Shakespeare, by the way. "As nail in door." "Away, Bardolph! Saddle my horse, Master Robert Shallow. Choose what office thou wilt in the land. 'Tis thine." "Boot, boot, Master Shallow. I know the young king is sick for me. Let us take any man's horses. The laws of England are at my commandment. Blessed are they that have been my friends, and woe to my Lord Chief Justice." Smooth expectations false. And now we come to, I think, the most painful scene Shakespeare ever wrote. We know what's coming. We know it has to come. We know the play is about justice. We know that justice will be delivered. But what we're not ready for is to see this man who has lived outside time, who's been a child at heart, although in this play he's aging. And we have a sense of age, death, disease. He's about to get justice. We don't want to watch it. And it's even worse than we anticipate. It's the coronation parade. The king has been crowned. He's walking through the streets of London to cheering crowds when suddenly from the crowd this old fat man breaks through, kneels before him and shouts, "God save thy grace, King Hal, my royal Hal. God save thee, my sweet boy, the king. My Lord Chief Justice, speak to that vain man. Have you your wits? Know you what 'tis you speak? My king, my Jove, I speak to thee, my heart. He means it. I know thee not, old man. Fall to thy prayers. How ill white hairs becomes a fool and jester. I have long dreamt of such a kind of man, so surfeit swelled, so old and so profane, but being awaked, I do despise my dream. Make less thy body hence and more thy grace. Leave gormandizing. Know that the grave doth gape for thee thrice wider than for other men. Reply not to me with a full-born jest. Presume not that I am the thing I was, for God doth know. So shall the world perceive that I have turned away my former self. So will I those that kept me company. When thou dost hear, I am as I have been, approach me, and thou shalt be as thou wast, the tutor and the feeder of my riots. Till then, I banish thee, on pain of death, as I have done the rest of my misleaders, not to come near our person by 10 mile. For competence of life I will allow you, that lack of means enforce you not to evils. And as we hear you do reform yourselves, we will, according to your strengths and qualities, give you advancement. Be it your charge, my lord, to see perform the tenor of my words. Set on. The next line comes from Falstaff himself, and there is nothing left of the man. He's gone. He admits a debt. Master Shallow, I owe you £1,000. And he's hauled away to prison. It has to happen. It's just. The problem is, the king does it publicly. And beyond what was necessary, and grinds certain harsh realities into the old man's face. We have a battle here. I call it a Shakespearean knot. Up here we say yes. Necessary. Has to happen. Justice. Here we go, oh, oh, oh. It is one of those true-to-life moments. It's real drama. He was told, banish Plump Jack and banish all the world. I do. I will. And he does. But on the street, in front of everyone, at length. And the old man doesn't protest. He goes off. We are told in the epilogue, the story will continue with Sir John in it. It's the last of the smooth expectations falls. We never see him again. He will die off stage in Henry V, and we'll hear about it. It is almost as if that entire age and the problems of that age get dumped on this old man, who becomes a scapegoat, a sacrificial figure. He deserves it, but we loved him. And if that can happen to someone we love so much, that we were willing to make allowances for and forgive, what about us? What about us? What do we deserve? I was in high school. It was 1965. I'd already become a Shakespeare devotee. I was reading everything I could. I loved this. Dear Marie Cal, my 8th and 9th grade English teacher, God rest her soul, she was a Catholic. She gave me my vocation as a teacher, and there are things about her that I have no doubt led me to convert to the Catholic Church. Great lady. Pray for her. Marie Cal, great lady. Well, I was reading Shakespeare, and I wanted to go to the Stratford Shakespeare Festival in Canada. And they were doing both parts of Henry IV and Julius Caesar in the cherry orchard. So I talked my parents into letting me get on a bus in Wisconsin and take the bus to Stratford and see all four plays and stay in a little hotel. And it was my first big adventure away from home. So I got the tickets, and I'm on the bus, and I'm rereading the plays, and I got to Stratford, and the productions were brilliant, brilliant, wonderful performers, well-directed, beautiful costumes. I was a young man in heaven. This was just wonderful. Saw Henry IV Part 1 the first night, saw Henry IV Part 2 the second night, couldn't leave my seat at the end of the play. My heart had been ripped to pieces. I couldn't get up and leave the theater. I finally crawled out of there. To quote Richard II, my eyes are filled with tears. I cannot see. Well, that's how I left the theater. Had a good night's sleep, got up the next morning. I was going to go see Julius Caesar, and I'm walking down the stairs to go get a little breakfast. There's an old woman from Stratford washing the stairs in the hotel. She said, good morning. I said, good morning. She said, are you here for the festival? I said, yes, I am. She said, what have you seen? I said, oh, I saw both parts of Henry IV. She said, oh, that Falstaff, me and the husband, we've been back to see it twice. My husband, he laughed so hard at that old fat man, he fell out of his chair. He says we may have to go back a third time. Oh, that's just, well, I'm glad you saw it. It's wonderful. I said, yes, I'm having a great time. I walk down the stairs and suddenly I hear her take the brush and throw it in the bucket. And I turn around and she's on her knees on the stairs weeping, sobbing. And she looked at me and she said, terrible. Terrible what that king did to that old man. And I started weeping and we stood on the stairs and wept. And then I went and had breakfast. Now I can make a defense of hell. And I understand its place in the play. But whenever I look at the play and when I read the play, I think of those words of that God bless her old washerwoman. Terrible. Terrible what the king did to that old man. That's drama. And this is great drama. Thank you. Take a break and do questions later, or would you like to do them now? It's up to you. Pardon?
Break.
Breaks are fine. I'm all in favor of them.